This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Survivor 48 is here. And after every episode, dig deep into the show with On Fire, the official Survivor podcast. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast with me, Jeff Probst, every Wednesday after the show, wherever you get your podcasts.
KYW Original Podcasts.
Hey,
how are you?
Say hi to Chris.
I'm Kristen. Sorry, hold on.
Glad you made it.
Yeah,
oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank you for coming out today to commemorate the America's Unknown Child, a young boy between the ages of 4 to 6. These Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts here today are helping to represent that boy. Could have been any one of them at that age. Troop 367 of the Boy Scouts is very proud of its Eagle Scouts. Dave, Matt, if you want to come.
I'm David Teasdale. I'm almost an Eagle Scout now. We'll probably never know his identity, and hopefully we will one day, but if we don't, it's great that he's remembered in some way, and this marker is a great way to do that.
I pray every day that one day we will be able to take down this sign and put up his real name, and even if the perpetrator did not face earthly judgment, Judgment Day is coming. And soon we'll, Soon we'll have his name, and one day, God knows that we'll figure out his identity, and his real name will be portrayed upon that sign. Thank you for coming out. And never forget this boy and his poor end on this earth.
I think there's a church. I think there's a church that we go by.
It should be St. Anselm, but you got that right.
Yeah, it's St. Anselm, yeah.
This is
Dunksbury. This is Dunksbury, wrong. Okay,
yeah.
Oh, this is so appropriate. The clouds are covering the sun, and it's beginning to snow, and we're approaching Potter's Field. That is just, I don't ever remember ever coming up here to do any of these burials or see the boy in the box site that it wasn't either a cloudy or a rainy day. It always felt like it was a moment just like this with the dark clouds. You just can't come to this Potter's Field and not feel the loneliness and the desperation here. One, two, one, two. Check, check. And then This would be where his grave was. This is it. This is it. Yep. That's where it was. That's not a mistake that sunk in like that. That's it.
It's one of the markers. Remember we talked about the markers, Tom?
Yeah.
That's virtually.
And you can't even see the marker. Like, it's so. It's three. Three? No. Oh, come on. Is that 350? 320?
I used to say in my stories, forgotten in life, forgotten in death. And that's pretty much the way it still is.
I do believe this is the saddest place in the city.
It is the saddest place. It is absolutely the saddest place there could possibly be.
From KYW News Radio.
In Philadelphia.
Philly.
Philadelphia.
But there was always that one little stone over there. It's like a little ray of hope.
These are true stories.
About unsolved crimes.
Of all the hundreds buried here, there was one little person that wasn't forgotten ever.
This was somebody's child. Who kills a little kid like that?
Whoever he is has really focused a lot of attention on a problem that is much, 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 much larger than just one criminal case, because there's an awful lot of forgotten people, and about 800 of them are here.
They're the cases that crawl into your soul when it's a kid, and I think this one more so than all of the others.
If this case could get solved when I'm alive and see that name when it's in, that would be, to me, a life worth lived.
Heavenly Father, we are here on earth for a brief time. If during that time our life has purpose, that is all we can hope for.
But I'm sure the boy's in heaven. And that would be nice. That would be the cherry on the sundae.
I'm Kristen Johansson.
I'm Tom Rickert.
This is Gone Cold.
So we're first going to do, Walt, an explanation of you and me and how we know each other. You go first.
Oh, well, that'll take... Where are we going? Are we driving to North Jersey?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, you ready?
How do you know me?
How do I know you? Kristen Johansson, my former intern circa 2003. And what's that? 16 years? And former coworker and... Former work daughter, former and current excellent KYW radio reporter. Now that I'm retired, I listen to you every morning. There we go. Yeah. Okay. What else do you want me to say?
All right, KJ. If you had to describe Walt Hunter,
he's a character. I want to say he had 35, 40 years in the broadcast business, an investigative reporter here in Philadelphia. Literally, I remember sitting when I was an assignment editor in meetings with, you know, news directors and executive producers where Walt would say, now, I have a little element about the boy in the box. We're like going around like who has what story. And I swear you'd hear the moans and the groans. Oh, God, Walt, again, another one with the boy in the box. No, this one's really cool.
How many stories have you done over the years about the boy in the box?
I would guess at least a dozen, 15, probably over the course of a 36-year career. So
he knows every detail about the case, about the theories. Walt knows about this case.
I would cover the burial of unclaimed people at the city's Potter's Field. Before they began doing cremations, they physically transported people whose bodies were not claimed or who were unclaimed or unidentified, and in one group they would bury them all on a particularly sad morning up at the Potter's Field, which was covered with junk and ruined cars, and they would clear off that area and bring in basically almost cardboard containers with the bodies and numbers identifying them written in crayon, and they would bury them, and a local group would come over from the local Catholic church and say a prayer. Prisoners would actually dig the graves for the unclaimed people in the Potter's Field, and then everyone would leave, and there was only one grave in that entire bleak field that was kept perfectly tended with flowers and always very neatly appointed. And it said, Heavenly Father, bless this unknown boy. And basically, from the minute you looked at that little gravestone, he was included in every story I ever did about the Potter's Field, but also on other stories I did about the investigation. So probably the launching pad for my stories was that tiny grave in the Potter's Field.
Walt Hunter was nice enough to hang out with us for most of a day. we got in one of the station cars and drove to Northeast Philly.
Yeah, far northeast, the same Potter's Field that we were in 2018, I want to say that was. God, that was, it feels like it wasn't that long ago. I want to get down to the facts. Tell me how he was found, where he was found, what it looked like from your understanding of what you listened to from investigators over the years.
Well, he was actually found by a young man who was out looking for his traps that he was using to trap muskrats. Back in those days, in 1957, Susquehanna Road was still very rural. This young man was trapping muskrats, which apparently was in violation of the game laws at those times. He actually spotted the body, but did not want his trapping activities to come to the attention of the police, so he never reported it. A few days later, there was a second person who found the body and finally reported that this little boy's body in a box was found on Susquehanna Road. When you read the accounts of how he was found in the box, absent the horrors that he endured in his death and the horrors that the autopsy showed he had been subjected to prior to his death, the old injuries, it would have almost looked like you were looking at a child at a viewing before a funeral. In a bizarre way, it almost looked like he had been what I think detectives would call staged, and put in a position where it was almost like he was on display, if you will, in some horrible way.
So, we are here to talk about you and talk about the Vioque Society, but also talk about the boy in the box.
Yes.
When did the Vioque Society first start getting interested?
I'll tell you exactly how it happened.
So there's another reason we asked Walt to help us out with this one. In addition to being a retired reporter who's covered the boy in the box for decades, Walt is also the communications guy for the Vioque Society.
Vioque Society is a unique group of what I would call the best and brightest criminal minds, not just in the city, but probably in the country, and you could probably argue some bit in the world. They gather every month to do an unsolved case.
The Vioque Society has basically adopted the boy in the box. To a member, they've never stopped trying to find out who he was and what happened to him. Two of them were nice enough to talk with us about him. Bill Fleischer is one of the founders of the Vioque Society.
Thank you so much for coming in. I just wanted to say that first and foremost.
My pleasure, Kristen. Thanks for asking me.
Barb Cohan is a former federal prosecutor who helps them solve crimes.
I've been in the Vioque Society, I think it's about 26 years. I am on the board of directors. I've been on the board for about 20 years, and I'm the membership director currently.
Both of them remember very clearly the first time they saw the boy.
When I was about 13 years old, I went to Penn Fruit Company in City Line Avenue. My mother, she walked into the store, and I looked at a poster of this young child propped up in a chair who was obviously dead, who was found in Fox Chase, and at the time I knew him as the Fox Chase boy.
I had just turned 6 when he was found. I used to go with my mother to the food fair on Roosevelt Boulevard, and I remember holding her hand, and she was looking at the flyer, and I think what drew us both to it was that I had a little brother. The boy, as pictured, looked exactly like my brother. And I can look at my brother's pictures from when he was that age and compare it to that poster, and it's chilling.
That's crazy.
I know that it drew my mother, and I remember her standing there just going, oh! She was just so affected by the killing of this child and the fact that no one knew who he was. And it became engraved in not only my brain, but my heart.
And I said, I never got that face and that picture out of my mind all these years. I see it right now as I'm talking to you.
What was that like to have? I don't think I've ever seen a flyer, a poster, or anything that has a dead body, let alone the dead body of a child on there. And then also the child they put in clothes to make him look more lifelike.
It was, I assume, a difficult decision to decide whether or not to put that picture out. They also, by the way, sent flyers around with people's, I believe, gas or water bills. They sent out some, I think, 400,000, if I'm not mistaken, flyers that went out with people's utility bills, the 1957 equivalent of putting something online or on social media. The other tool that was not available to them back then, the artistic facial reconstruction, which Frank Bender, our BDoc Society co-founder and beloved artist, eventually did. We take it for granted, especially with the technology that we have. You can whip one of those up relatively quickly. That was unheard of in 1957. So the bottom line is the decision in 1957 was either put out a picture of a dead little boy's face or risk, in those important opening moments of the investigation, maybe not getting feedback that might have solved the case. It was a much more difficult decision back then.
The body, one of the reports, was found by an officer named Elmer Palmer, who's now deceased. And the second guy on the scene was Sam Weinstein, who I knew was a detective. And they were the first ones on the scene. After someone called in, they found a doll or a body in a box up on Susquehanna Road. So I said to the guys, I said, I know Sammy Weinstein. Let me give him a call. I said, Sam, do you remember when you were the boy in the box up there? And so, like, it was yesterday. And they found him in a Sears bassinet case. He says, no, it was a JCPenney. He knew, like, a photographic memory of everything. On Susquehanna Road, I guess on the south side of what would be called the road, there was a short, what they called a short dump, where people just throw their garbage and discard their, you know, appliance boxes or whatever they didn't, the trash people wouldn't, they just drive by and they dump it there. It was this young boy, nude, in the box, between 3 and 6 years old. They weren't quite sure how old he was. His hair was crudely haircut. His nails were pared, and he was deceased. So they initiated an investigation as a homicide. There was some bruising on his face and head.
He was very slight, small-boned, blonde hair, blondish. He appeared to be very fair. There were some scratches, if I recall, on his face, some bruising. And he was very thin. For the postmortem picture, they just kind of propped him up to take pictures.
Clothes you see in these old posters, they circulate, they were a detective's child's clothes. He dressed them up so he wouldn't, you know, be a nude.
How long do you think he was dead before he was found?
It was like a day or two. It wasn't long. It wasn't long.
He was found in a cardboard box, wrapped in a blanket. The police did a really tremendous job trying to track down the box.
It was a bassinet box, and so many were sold, and they tracked as many of them down as they could and never drew any fruition. You can never find out who that particular box belonged to, and it may have just been something that was laying there.
The blanket was distinctive, and they were trying to track down where it could have come from. But we just don't know.
This is just one of those ones where it's like haunted so many people for so long. This kid shows up in a box. And I think the other weird thing with this is it's not just a kid that was like beaten and tossed to the side. I think it also was because he was like meticulously kept and then cared for, and then put in a box in the woods. that makes it like eerie. And no one knew about a missing boy.
Gone Cold, we'll be right back.
I'm Matt Leon, sports reporter and anchor here at KYW News Radio. Talking to athletes, coaches, people in Philly sports every day, you find out they have incredible stories to tell. So I started a podcast, a weekly conversation with someone you should know more about. It's called One-on-One with Matt Leon. Subscribe now wherever you listen.
Welcome back to Gone Cold.
If you know Potter's Field, the history of Potter's Field, that's sort of like the detritus of society. People, they're homeless, or nobody knows who they are, or nobody claims their body. They were buried in a potter's field, and it comes, the origin of Potter's Field goes back to biblical times. That's where Judas hung himself, in the potter's field. So wherever city that they didn't have a place to bury, you know, the fancy people or the people who could afford a proper funeral, they put in, quote, Potter's Field.
It's a dumping ground of the flotsam and jetsam of humanity, but at least you try to give the bodies some dignity, even if they have no names and no families and no one has claimed them. But his little grave was well tended.
I used to always go over when I came in here and check on the grave, and of course it was always trimmed because this was really overgrown. This field looks fantastic compared to the way it used to look.
Yeah.
And this grave was always kept neatly trimmed, and there was always, sometimes there were plastic flowers, sometimes someone put fresh flowers, but it was right here. This is definitely where it was.
And he was the only one of a marker that was paid for and got a funeral that was paid for by the cops, the detectives that worked on the case.
Some of the elderly members of the VDOC Society went there until they died. We're dropping. We're aging. And those of us who remain are just as dedicated to bringing this one home as those guys were. Except now we want to do it for them as well as for him.
It looks really nice right now.
Yeah, looks great right now. It wasn't that way back when they were actually burying people here.
This is my first time out here.
It's probably not anything that you see. It's more what you don't see and more what you feel. It's the emptiness of it and the knowledge that 800 or more people who came into the world, hopefully loved and adored, and went out of the world completely ignored and not even claimed by people who knew who they were. Again, they weren't all anonymous. A lot of them were identified, but people said, I just don't care, just do something with them. And there's a whole range of indignities you can face over the course of a lifetime, but to have someone not care about you in your passing is probably up somewhere toward the top.
So over the years, if all you were to know about this case was reading about it online, it seems like there have been a couple leads that popped up, and some of them looks a little more promising than others. And
yeah, right. And we all have our theories. It's not unlike the JonBenet Ramsey case. Every guy in VDOC has their own theory. But it's, you know what I say about theories? They're like cowboy hats. Every jerk has one. Now, I have colleagues. They're convinced it's the Carney and that family.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, there was a guy, and he passed through Philadelphia. He used to work in carnivals. And he'd travel with his wife and a bunch of children, and through the way, some of the children would die for various reasons. And he'd leave them in the trash, or he'd leave them on the side of the road, and he finally got caught and went to jail. It was never connected.
The boys' parents, who were carnival workers, that never held water either, right? Yeah.
No, it's possible. I mean, it's entirely possible. There are one or two members of the VDOC Society who are passionate about that theory. I am not one of them.
You have the Carney theory.
Yeah.
You have the foster home theory.
Yep. Oh, Sam and I went up there. We walked around the property, and there were a lot of. It was kind of interesting. The owner used to give the kids haircuts.
What I've heard behind the area where his little body was dumped, there used to be a home for wayward girls. There were a number of unwed mothers among them, and it was not uncommon to dump a child born out of wedlock. And there were some theories that there was some connection to the house.
Sam and I went up there, walked around that property. We saw things that were coincidental to when Remington Bristol was looking for leads, he went to a psychic.
I guess in a lot of cold cases, there comes a time when the detectives are just saying to themselves, like, what else can we possibly try? Everybody was at the end of their rope with this case. They had no idea what else to do to try to figure out who this kid was. So the medical examiner says, all right, tried everything else. Why don't we try hiring a psychic?
Now you can say, all right, have some uncanny ability. Some of them are just pure showbiz Hollywood. They're full of it.
And so they hired a psychic, and doing that sort of opened the door to another one of these theories that has lasted until today.
And this particular psychic, I don't know who it was, saw a little corral, saw a little pond, and all these things were found at this Moreland Avenue address just outside the city up there. So, again, cowboy hats. A lot of theories.
Frankly, the reason I've never really paid a lot of attention to that particular theory, first of all, it's too easy. It's just too easy. And why dump the body there? That theory came about, or at least came to my attention, around the same time as the Martha story.
If you had to theorize, you know, with the years, the decades that you've thought about this case, what do you think happened to the boy in the box?
I think exactly what one of the witnesses who came forward that sort of discounted said. And basically, he was sort of a throwaway child. Let's put it this way. Whatever this witness said, I have found nothing that contradicted it. Whatever this witness said, I found amazing correlations to the facts as we know them. But the person went back to non-cooperation. And I'm for one, she was given the word by Bill Hirschi. Was given the word by Bill Kelly, Tom Augustine, Joe McQuillan, that they would never reveal her or his identity unless they released them. And I hold to that. I won't discuss or speculate or talk about that. As people have. It's out there written things, but I you know.
The Martha story, because of the way it came out, that the initial contact was not by her but by her psychiatrist, there were people who discounted her theory because it came from her psychiatrist. But frankly, anybody who claims to have lived the experiences that she described could very well need a psychiatrist. So it doesn't diminish its credibility in my view.
So this woman, Martha, lives in Ohio, and she ends up getting in touch with police and claims that she knows what happened to the boy.
She had accompanied her mother, I believe, many, many years ago to a wooded area in Philadelphia, and her mother went to the door of this ramshackle house, and some money was exchanged, and the boy was then turned over to her. The story, as I recall it, was that the boy was kept, that he was somehow, I guess, I don't know what we would call it today, but the way she described it, he had some mental deficiencies and was kept in a cage in the basement of a house and brought upstairs essentially to be a sex slave to her parents. It was horrific.
He was kept in a almost like an object of art, not as a human.
There was so much about her story that had the ring of truth. Now, it may not be completely accurate. She was a child at the time, so parts of it could be, I don't know, filling in the gaps, if not completely misremembered, misheard, or whatever. But according to her account, the mother had brought the boy upstairs to bathe him.
At some point, he was eating baked beans, which was consistent with what the autopsy. He had some brown substances in his digestive system. He got it all over or threw up or something, and the custodian, so to speak, took him up to give him a bath.
It's not clear whether he had a seizure or there was some kind of incident.
Maybe he slipped and hit his head on the tile.
And he died.
He might have been a very weakened state because there was evidence that they had some kind of medical problem. At least he was treated for something. He didn't seem to be nourished, that he may be underweight due to malnutrition. And he just, it was like, I always thought of it as like a candle going out. He just died.
And I can't remember whether Martha said her mother or if she had actually cut his hair, which is consistent with the way his hair was choppily cut.
And then in a panic, they took him up to the short dump up on Susquehanna Road and left him to be like he was a piece of garbage. Who knows if it hadn't been found? They just piled on more junk, trash. Became skeleton eyes, and you have animals up there. You know, it's just fateful that he was found, and at least the investigation can continue.
It's a bizarre story. But as I said, coming to us from a psychiatrist out of town, the pieces fit what we knew. And if I've learned nothing else in 40-some years of practicing law, 30 of those as a prosecutor, there is nothing that is so far-fetched that it couldn't be true.
This theory in particular is really frustrating because so many of the details from what the person called Martha says happened match up with what investigators found. But it gets complicated. Martha's mother denied everything. And then Martha recants her testimony and does not cooperate anymore. So, you know, you think looking at this, oh yeah, you know, this is obviously what happened, or someone can think that. But what are you going to do with it? That you no longer have a cooperating witness. And that you found similarities, but you didn't find any actual evidence that what she said happened was true.
Right. This is another gray area because you can't write it all off, but you can't necessarily point to it.
It feels like every new development in this case is just another, it's just a question mark. It opens more questions than it closes.
Yeah.
I think what really tugs at me every time I see an Ancestry.com commercial or every time I hear about new triumphs with genealogical DNA, anybody that I am walking down the street with or happen to ride on the train with or happen to see could be a relative of this little boy.
What kind of evidence is there in this case now? You know, this was.
We still have the original DNA that was collected when we reinterred him. We have the statements of these various people, the theories. That's about it. That's the evidence we have.
the length and the elasticity and the depth and the breadth of DNA is staggering. What strikes me every time I hear about the case is this incredible, heartbreaking what if, or if only, had that technology existed in that day, we wouldn't be doing this story.
In the past 10 years, has there been any hope that this case has gone going anywhere?
Well, where there's life, there's hope. There's always been hope. We have some things that, you know, I can't discuss that we're looking at. And so I'm hopeful.
This case is, in many ways, still living. This was 1957. It wasn't 1802. There are still genetic ancestors, probably, or relatives of this little boy out there somewhere. And people may actually know something about this that don't realize they know something about this. It is still that potentially active, even though it is such a long time ago.
The fact that he was so young and so innocent, it just burrowed into everybody's hearts and stayed there. I maintain the Vidoc Society's Facebook page, and every year when we go to Susquehanna Road or if we go up to Ivy Hill Cemetery, I post pictures. I take pictures and I post them. The response, even on the Facebook page, from people who have nothing to do with the Vidoc Society, from all over the country, is just passionate. Thank you for remembering him. This is not strictly a local phenomenon. I'm not sure who nicknamed him America's Unknown Child, but if it wasn't true when he got the nickname, it certainly is now. We've got to bring this one home. We got to try, at least to put a name on him.
So in November of 1998, they exhume his body for DNA.
Henry Mann was a funeral director. He buried the lad gratis. I asked Tom Augustine, I said, how do we go about getting an exhumation order? And he said, call Craig Mann, Henry Mann's son. I asked him how you do it, and he told me in the police department, went through the DA's office, they got an order.
It was super controversial at the time because the idea, obviously, when you bury someone is that they're at peace, they're at rest, you bury them, you're not supposed to exhume their body. But DNA, because it's an organic material, you only have a certain amount of time that you can pull DNA, and it was within that time frame. So they exhumed his body in November of 1998.
In the meanwhile, Sam Weinstein says to me, he says, you know, maybe we can do something better for this kid. Make him a symbol of all abused and murdered children. Let's call him America's Unknown Child, and let's find a nice cemetery for him instead of putting him back in the hole in Potter's Field. I said, that's a great idea.
I see a little grave with, like, teddy bears. Let's see. And, of course, like Walt said, it's raining.
But I called back Craig Mann. I said, we're thinking of putting him in some other location, a more respectable burial site.
This is it.
And the VDOC Society will pay for it. And we want to make him a symbol of all children that have been abused or murdered and call him America's Unknown Child. He says, Bill, I got the perfect place, Ivy Hill Cemetery. I said, well, how much is going to cost? Because I got to go in front of the board. He says, nothing. They're donating this spot. I said, but we're going to need a headstone, and we want to pay for it. He calls me back. He says, I got you a headstone. I said, how much is it? Of course, I got to run it by the board. Nothing. They're donating it. And he said, what do you want in a headstone?
So basically, there's all these little toys, some faded, some bright, that are surrounding this gravestone. The gravestone is like a dark granite gray, and it has a lamb at the top engraved in it. And it says, America's Unknown Child, dedicated November 11th of 1998.
I said, I'd like to have a stone bench there, a bench where people could come and reflect and visit the boy periodically. And I insist that the VDOC Society pays for that. And we did.
sits under a tree. And of course it's raining and the branches are bare. But it sits under a tree, and it's next to it is a light gray granite bench with a dedicated by the VDOC Society. There's also a teddy bear right here.
We had a big reinterment ceremony. We had the police chaplain, the priest. We had the Protestant and Jewish. And I think we had an imam come up, and of course we didn't know what religion he was, and do a service, and we reinterred him, and it was just, when we got there, it was pouring. As soon as we get to 10 o'clock, it's supposed to start, we walk out, the sun comes out, like as bright as if you're in Miami or someplace. I said, boy, you know, he's looking down, going to make it a day for this young lad. And that's where we're at now. And people go there every year. We get there, there's toys there, and people stop by, and it's nice and it's poignant. But
hi.
We want to put a name on that stone.
How are you? Disturbing you?
I'm sorry?
Am I disturbing you?
No, you're not. Are you here for him?
Yes.
Oh, you are?
Yes.
Oh, what's your name? Oh, you don't have to. I'm Kristen. No, I'm Kristen. I am.
Those in there.
I didn't realize that today was the day that he was found.
Yeah. A car pulls up.
How are you connected?
His picture everywhere, you know, haunted me for... And my dad was a Philadelphia policeman.
She tells me that her dad was a police officer. He was a patrolman. And he tried to go house to house, like during the investigation, and just with flyers ask, do you know who this is? And that it stuck with him forever.
And he passed away a little over a year and a half now. He would have been 95 the next month. But, you know, he always... And when he couldn't go, then I started coming. So.
Do you remember the flyers?
Oh, I see them in... Like I said, they were everywhere.
And obviously I got very excited talking to her because it was, you know, I wasn't expecting to see anybody there, and just the timing... worked out that, you know, she pulled up right around the same time.
I know.
Can I ask you, what does it mean to you? I mean, what would it mean to you to get this, to figure out who he was and then possibly find out who he belonged to? What would that mean to you just as a Philadelphia citizen?
Not so much who he belonged to, because I just can't imagine anybody doing something like this for this long of a time, letting this go. But just that he would have a name, that, you know, he lived here, he was a person forever, how short he was here, he actually has a name. You know, a child of God that didn't deserve this, but at least he could have a name.
I've been thinking about that so much in, you know, prepping for doing this episode, about how, like, our whole goal here at Gone Cold is to help people whose voices have been taken from them tell their stories anyway. But what we do that is we interview family members and people who loved him. And I was wondering, like, what about, we don't even know who he was.
But you're talking to an uncle. Phil Kelly was an uncle. Joe McGill was an uncle. And Barb Cohan, if she's supposed to come in and talk to you, she's an aunt. And the cops, Bob Kohlmeyer, the cold case sergeant over in Philadelphia, is still working this case. We're his family. Like he belongs to us.
So in the best universe where someone listens to this podcast and hears something, what's the best way for them to give some information?
Well, I would call the Philadelphia Police Homicide. If they feel that, you know, maybe they're too shy or they're worried or whatever, they can send an anonymous letter to the police administration, Bill Intention Homicide. If they're still worried about that, they could drop a letter to the VDOC Society at 1704 Locust Street, 19103 in Philadelphia, and we'll make sure the police get it.
You can leave a tip for Philly Homicide at 215-686-TIPS. That's 215-686-8477. Or you can do it online, too. Just Google Philadelphia Homicide Tips, and you'll get there. This episode was actually a return to Potter's Field for Gone Cold. In the summer of 2018, Kristen went there
talk with some detectives and scientists. They had come to North Philly to find the remains of another unidentified child buried there, a girl who was found in the 1960s. You can find out what happened by listening to the episode from a couple years ago. It's called The Bones in a Potter's Field. If you like listening to Gone Cold, we want to ask you a favor. Leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts can really help other people find out about the show. That's an amazing way to help us out. If you don't want to leave a rating and review, that's fine too. But make sure you're following us online to keep up with what we're doing. We're on Instagram and Twitter at Gone Cold Philly. And you can join our Facebook group too at facebook.com/groups/GoneColdPhilly. Gone Cold Philadelphia Unsolved Murders is a KYW original podcast. Our theme music is by Obi Daz. I'm Tom Rickert.
I'm Kristen Johansson. Thanks for listening.